I want you to picture this. Her name is Kayla. She's 17, alone, terrified, and pregnant. Sitting in a clinic, tears blurring, thinking abortion is her only option. Until she was offered a free ultrasound, paid for by a hero just like you. The moment Kayla heard her baby's heartbeat, the decision was made. And today, her little boy, Gabriel, is thriving because preborn walked with Kayla every step of the way. Now, multiply that by 38,000. That's how many babies preborn has helped save just this year. How many mothers preborn has come alongside with practical and spiritual resources to make motherhood possible. But here's the most important thing you will hear today. Their goal is to save 70,000 babies by the end of the year, and they can't do it without us. Every $28 provides that ultrasound the moment everything changes. Will you be the reason the next Kayla chooses life? The reason Gabriel fulfills his destiny? To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250, baby. Or donate securely at preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
We inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to At the Core with Walker Wobbin and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. Thanks for joining me today. I'm going to be diving back into biblical citizenship this week. No better way to do Thanksgiving than to be thankful for what we've been given in this nation, what God's given us from the beginning, a nation that is free, and we have the right to, not only the right, but we have the duty and responsibility to live out those freedoms. And to do that well, we got to know what those freedoms are. So that's why we keep sharing biblical citizenship in modern America. A couple weeks ago, I was sharing on several days some of the biblical citizenship videos, or at least the audio of it, and we ran out of time. And so I'm going to jump into the one that we were in the middle of, I think 2 weeks ago. I can't remember the exact date, but we were right in the middle of our first episode that takes place in Independence Hall. So we're in the room, reliving some of those things, bringing to life some of the Declaration of Independence. So I'm going to actually pick up a few minutes of what we already aired from a couple of weeks ago, just so you'll get the context and we won't be in the middle of a story that we drop into. And we're going to knock out some of biblical citizenship this week. So today, Tuesday, and then again on Thursday during Thanksgiving, we'll be doing a little bit more biblical citizenship, being thankful for the country. There's an awful lot of great Thanksgiving proclamations. I may even share a couple of those with you on Thursday, from Lincoln to FDR to, you know, the Continental Congress, just lots of great ones that really talk about our reliance on God. But for now, let's jump back in on biblical citizenship in modern America, where we left off a couple of weeks ago.
John Francis Mercer, he actually told us that this document right here is not enough, that what they were framing would not be enough to guarantee freedom. In fact, he said it's a great mistake to suppose the paper we are to propose will govern the United States. He said the Constitution will not govern the United States. Say, wait a minute, I thought we came here to study the Constitution because it's governing the United States. He said, no, it's the men whom it will bring into the government. See, it's going to set up the rules for how we choose our leaders and how they're supposed to govern. So it does set up the rules, but it's not going to govern us. It's the men whom it will bring into the government and the interest they have in maintaining it that will govern them. The paper will only mark out the mode and the form, kind of like that frame. Men are the substance and must do the business. What he's saying is this document's great, but if we the people put people in office and on the bench, they're willing to ignore it, willing to shred it, willing to distort it, willing to govern around it, it just doesn't mean anything anymore. The document doesn't govern us. The people we put into government is what governs us. So if we want to uphold this document, then we have to make wise decisions in choosing our leaders. We have to be part of the process even as it goes on, even after you choose the leaders. Being engaged in our government, watching what's happening, letting our voice be heard constantly, just like these guys did in their lifetime. So that's the philosophy that they gave us. There is a God. There are truths. There's right and wrong worth fighting for, worth dying for. Our system of government will work if we'll just be willing to give or refuse that consent. Being engaged will make those seeds of liberty spring forth. They'll give us a great nation of freedom. So now that we know the seeds of liberty, now that we know how we're going to do this, we're going to dive into the Constitution itself. When we come back in our next section, we're going to do kind of a 30,000 feet view, if you will. We're going to step back and look at the entire Constitution all at once, and then we'll start zooming into specific areas that are most under attack or most in question today. Sort of like our quick start guide, we're going to look for those places we need to be plugging things in and making sure that they work. So when we come back, we'll talk about that 30,000 feet view.
Establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare.
Well, I guess you could tell Rhett was having as much fun as you and I have.
Well, so were you in the background watching Rhett, so you had a lot of fun too.
We love teaching those principles from that very room. Now, before we get to the 30,000 feet view.
And by the way, I think that was the third thing, was to teach the rising generation. I think that's the third objective.
There you go, getting those little guys in there. That is the rising generation. So in our next chapter, we'll get the 30,000 feet view on the Constitution itself. But before we do that, some more on these seeds of liberty. Yeah. Rhett was doing a little bit. He did four principles out of the Declaration. You go further in a couple of other paragraphs there and broaden it out to six principles.
Yeah, Rhett got some really good application, like the free market systems they showed there. There's so many good things there. Let's go back and back up just the overview of the Declaration, because it's National Birth Certificate. But there's 155 words up top that set forth six immutable principles.
Okay.
Those six principles are followed by 27 grievances and then the declaration that because of these principles, the violation of them in 27 different categories, we're now going to become a separate nation. So when you look at those principles, let's just take clauses out of those 155 words, because this is the essence, this is the key. By the way, this is what you've been working on with other states with the Celebrate Freedom Week is to get them to learn these kind of principles. So what you've got
is... get into the founding documents.
Get into the founding documents, real simple. Stuff. Yeah. So you have the clause in the Declaration that says all men are created equal, they're endowed by their Creator. Now, what does that tell us is our first principle, that there is a divine Creator. Now, today we're told, well, you can believe that, but not everybody believes in the Creator, so that's why government can't take a position favoring religion over non-religion. That's what the courts have told us for these 40 years of judicial activism.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. That document, it says that it's the unanimous declaration of the 13 states of America. That doesn't sound like private individuals talking. This is the unanimous declaration of all the elected officials from those 13 states sent to the Continental Congress, and later on...
This is what we agreed on, right? This is what brought us together.
This is our public declaration to the world of why we're doing what we're doing. Why we're doing what we're doing, because we in America believe there is a divine creator, and that becomes the first step in limited government. You cannot have limited government if you think government's at the top of the pecking order.
Yeah.
If government's at the top, then what limits it? There's got to be something higher than government. If there's nothing higher than... So we said, hey, there's a creator that's higher than everything, and that's why government is limited. It doesn't get to do... It's not the creator. It doesn't get to do everything the creator does. It's below the creator.
Yeah.
So our thing is, all right, we believe there's a creator. We've been created, and the creator gets the right to tell his creation what to do, so government, listen up.
And that one principle has a huge impact on what kind of nation you're going to be.
It's a huge impact. You find me any secular government in the world that's a limited government, can't do it. It's an oxymoron. You cannot find it. France, Greece, maybe China, no. We can't go to Cuba. Can't do Sweden. Can't do Norway. Can't do Chile. You can't find a secular government.
If God's not in the equation, government has to be even bigger.
Government is
even
God.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
There will be a supreme authority, and if it's not God, it will be government.
Yeah.
So if you don't get the declaration concept right, that God's at the top, then government thinks it's at the top, and therefore, when it gives you a right, it can regulate that right, it can repeal that right, it can take it away. If God's at the top, if God gives you a right, government, you keep your stinking hands off that, because it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God. It's a jurisdictional issue.
Good.
So that's the first point. The second point is based on that. It says they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. So number one, not only is there a creator, he gives us a certain set of rights. These aren't given by government. They come from the creator. Therefore, government, these don't belong to you. It's, you know, you and I both live in Texas. I'm a cowboy. I've got the ranch, got all the stuff, and I got the pickup that goes with it. And I got
but no cowboy hat worn here today.
Not on this.
Not here.
Very often on the ranch.
That's right. Yeah.
I like my pickup. I got a red Ford pickup. And I've looked over at yours, and you got a gray Dodge. I don't like gray. I'm going to go over and paint your pickup red, because I like red pickup. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I don't have the jurisdictional authority to go over into something that doesn't belong to me and change it. And that's what we do with government. I say, hey, government, these rights over here They come from God. They don't belong to you. You didn't give them. They come from God. Therefore, you cannot go over there and mess with them. Same way I can't go mess with your pickup. I may not like a Dodge, may not like gray. Doesn't matter. I don't have the authority to do anything to
your
pickup.
That changes everything when you really think about the authority, because a nation without God, that government has the authority to do anything they want, because like you said, they're God.
You choose any other nation in the world that is secular, and you know, in Germany right now, they literally, it's a crime to homeschool your kids, because you're not the one over your, in America, we've held for generations a position supreme Court articulated in the case called Pierce versus Society Sisters of Mount Nebraska, that it's the fundamental right of parents to direct the education, upbringing, and care
not
of their
the
children.
State. It's the
not
parent.
The state. But over there, no. Parents, you belong to the state. The kids in Scotland, we were talking to a guy recently who said in Scotland, from the time you're born, every kid is assigned a government official liaison to the state.
I remember that on our radio
That's
show.
Right.
Yeah, I started thinking about it. Imagine that, if every kid's assigned
they
somebody
assume
from the state
every kid belongs
to
monitor the state.
Them.
That's right.
Yeah.
Every kid belongs to the state. Therefore, we have to assign you a government official the time you're born, time you come to this earth. You don't belong to your parents. Wait a minute. We believe you do. We believe that the parents are the authority because God made the parents.
So these initial principles really matter in your day-to-day life. It's not just books and old documents. This impacts our lives.
And it's not just, well, if you believe in God, that's fine. That's your private belief. But don't bring it in public with you. If I don't bring it in public with me, you don't have a limited government.
You're going to lose all those.
You're going to lose all the inalienable rights. So that's the second point.
Okay.
The third point is very simple. It says that to secure these rights, government should institute among men. Now we have the purpose of government. Purpose of government is to protect inalienable rights. Those God-given rights, government exists to protect those God-given rights. Now, significantly, government does not exist to make sure we all have a job or that we've got a great economy. Government exists to make sure that we have a certain set of rights that nobody can violate, nobody can take away. Now, once we've done that, and if you do that, then you will have a prosperous government. You will have a limited government. You will have freedom. And with freedom, we take off. I mean, we're gangbusters with freedom. We invent things. We find things. We discover things. We're entrepreneurs. This 4% of the world population in America boosts more than 96% of the world every year with inventions and patents and everything else. I mean, we're more creative because we have more freedom.
Because this formula
Because that formula out there.
So you're saying, so government is there to protect, not provide.
It's there
to protect you, and then you go out and earn and produce.
If they will keep thieves off my back, I will go and take my ideas. If they will keep somebody from stealing my ideas, I'll go and I'll create a McDonald's in every corner. Yeah. I'll create a Walmart in every city. If you'll just keep people from stealing my ideas.
And if just that principle was taught today, we wouldn't have government growing so much, because we've shifted that. Now we think government's job is to provide us with every little need that we
and
have.
And the more it provides, the less prosperous you become, because the less initiative you have and the less creative you are. Government's not creative. It is never creative. Government doesn't discover things. They don't file patents and cures and whatever.
Right.
You know, they have monopolies if they keep the private citizen from doing it, but they're not the creative source. So that's the third principle.
Okay.
Fourth principle says, and to assume among the powers of the earth a separate and equal station which the laws of nature and nature's God entitles them. We'll talk about this more later. But that told every person in that generation that there is a fixed moral law. There are certain laws you cannot cross, and they are called the laws of nature and nature's God. Now, we don't know what that means today, but we'll show you literally the books where the founding fathers took that phrase, what it meant, how they understood it. But there are certain absolute rights and wrongs. We live in a culture today that says, well, if it's right for you, it's right for you, but I don't think it's right. And no, you can't have a culture that says, well, rape is okay sometimes, but not okay. And, theft is okay if it's for the right reason. You can't be Machiavellian and justifies the means. Rape's okay sometimes, theft's okay sometimes, and a white lie doesn't hurt anything. No, you got to have fixed rights and wrongs. Perjury is not okay if it's for a good reason. You can't perjure yourself under oath if it's a little white. No, you have to have fixed absolutes.
But if there is no moral law, then
you
goes,
are.
Right?
If there's no moral law, it becomes anarchy, because I will decide what is right and
then
wrong.
Then I get to decide what's right for me.
And if I have if my AR-15 has 30 shots in the mag rather than yours that has 20, I'm more right than you are.
Depends on how good of a shot you are.
No, that's true, too.
But I get your point. No, that's exactly right. I mean, now there's no fix, like you said.
John Quincy Adams said, at that point, you have the law of the tiger and the shark. That's where gangs rule. That's where guys with the biggest fist rule.
Yeah.
That's not what you want. You have to have fixed moral laws that nobody can transgress. You don't cross these laws. The fifth thing you have from the Declaration says, government is instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now, what you get with this is what we call the consent of the governed, or the will of the majority. There's nothing in the Constitution that ever allows anything smaller than a majority to win a vote. Unless you're in the U.S. Senate today, and because of the filibuster, 40 beats 60 every time. Founding fathers opposed that. That's why they did not allow filibusters, was the rule of the majority. Now, this is point number five, and it comes only after you've said there are inalienable rights and only after you've said there is a fixed moral law. We don't get to vote on whether rape will or won't be a crime, because that's part of the fixed, that's part of the laws of nature and nature's God.
Yeah.
We don't get to vote on whether you're going to lose your right to keep and bear arms, because that's an inalienable right. The right to defend yourself is a God-given right. God gave it to you, not the government. government, we can't vote that we're going to take that away from you. So the consent of the government is good when you talk about, do we want the sidewalk to be 4 feet wide or 5 feet wide or 6 feet wide? Do we want the speed limit to be 45 or 55? Or if you're in Texas, 85? That's what we can do on the consent of the government. But we cannot vote on inalienable rights or fixed moral laws. That's the principles of the Declaration. And the sixth principle is...
consent of the government doesn't overrule those basic truths. And
government exists to protect those truths. Yeah. And with those truths, we can have a civilized culture and move forward.
It doesn't mean we just put our finger to the wind and whatever's popular at the time changes those fixed points.
That's we can put our finger to the wind on sidewalk size as the speed limits, but we can't put our finger to the wind on moral laws and on inalienable rights.
That's a great point.
That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's the right of the people to alter or to abolish and institute new government. It's destructive of what ends? If you get a government that does not do the first five things, if you get a government that says there is no creator, the creator does not give you certain guaranteed rights, government does, we don't exist to protect those rights, and by the way, there is no moral law, there's no rights and wrongs except what we tell you to do, and there's no consent of the government, we will decide what you... If you get a government that won't uphold the first five things, it says it's the right of the people to alter or abolish and institute new government. That is the sixth principle of government. We have a lot of changes have gone on in our constitutional government today, and they didn't happen by the people. The president, by fiat of one pen, decides he's going to change the government. The Supreme Court decides we need to make policy. We don't like that legislative body across it. You cannot have the branches going in and redefining their roles.
It's violating
the first five principles.
Yeah.
The only way that we get the success, prosperity, freedom, liberty, everything we enjoy is those first five principles. And because government comes from the people, if those first five principles, which are our needs, are not met, then we can start this thing over, or we can pass constitutional amendments, 27 of them. We can change our government, however, but it always comes back to us. You can't have any branch change itself.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You're listening to At the Core with Michael Waldman and Rick Green.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
We're back on At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. We are learning some biblical citizenship in modern America. This is actually, we're kind of in the middle of week four. So just to back up, take a bigger picture here, biblical citizenship in modern America, our most popular Constitution class ever. It's an 8-week course. And so we aired the first 3 weeks a few weeks ago, and now we're jumping back in where we left off. And I think basically we'd gotten through part of week four. None of that really matters. You just enjoy, listen, learn. But what I want you to know is that there's a lot of material here, a lot of really, really good stuff, and all of it is available for free. So if you go to patriotacademy.com right now and sign up as one of our Constitution hosts or coaches, you get access to all of our courses, including this one. And you can actually host people in your living room or your church, and for free, they can come watch the videos with you. You can get workbooks, I mean, all that. But it's a great way to learn. It's a great way to be going into Thanksgiving. It's a great way to be going into the end of the year and then into the 250th next year. Anyway, let's jump back in. But if you want to get the whole course, go to patriotacademy.com. Here we are with biblical citizenship in modern America.
Great thing for us, we can actually do that in a peaceable means in our nation. We've been given the tools to alter or abolish
government. We do not have to have revolutions to do this.
Yeah, or a revolution with ballots instead of with bullets.
See, that's the revolution we need, because at this point in American history, based on national statistics, only one out of three Americans vote in presidential elections. Only one out of four vote in non-presidential elections, which means... since it takes a majority, with only one out of three voting presidential elections, that means that half of that, one out of three, chooses the president, which is about 18%, 17%, which means five out of six Americans are not choosing the president right now, and seven out of eight Americans are not choosing their governors.
But they're living with the consequences.
They're living with the consequences.
Yeah, it's impacting
their lives. Have a revolution, show up at the ballot box and say, I've had it. I'm not going to be part of that five out of six that don't vote for my president anymore. I'm going to vote for my president. Here's what I'm going to get. And when we decide to do that, we can have an easy revolution. So the six principles that are very simple here is, one, there's a divine creator. Two, inalienable rights come from God. Three, government exists to protect those rights. Four, there's a fixed moral law. Five, you have the consent of the governed below the moral law and inalienable rights. And six is, if we don't get these five things, we can change it till we do. So that's
now
the
six principles. We mentioned where some of this comes from. Back in Philadelphia, we talked about that Richard Henry Lee mentioned that John Locke's two treatises of government had a huge impact on Jefferson. Okay, this is the coolest thing you've ever given given me. Actually, I have to admit, you loaned it to me, but possession's 9/10 of the law.
You're right.
I've had it for about 10 years now, so I'm claiming
attorney.
It, but someday it'll be go back.
Let's hear you go argue that in court, attorney. Come on.
All right, this is John Locke's Two Treasons of Government. This is, I believe, a 1784 version or 74 version, if I remember right. So this is Locke.
That's a 1774
version. Oh, you got me beat right there. The dueling Locke books. So tell us more about Locke, though, because I hear a lot of people say a lot of negative things about him, and if he was such an influence on the founders, then that means they weren't religious guys, they didn't believe in God. What can we
One of the things you know for sure about Locke, and political scientists have documented that he was one of the three most frequently cited individuals in the founding era. Founding era goes from 1760 through 1805. In that era where we're establishing and operating our first constitutional government, he's one of the top three guys.
Now, so if we want to really understand the document itself, mm-hmm. we need to know a little bit about the guys that, a lot he, about the guys that gave it.
He is the guy in the 1760s and 1770s. He is the guy quoted most often because that's the age where we did the Declaration. Richard Henry Lee, you mentioned, he said that they, quote, copied the Declaration from those two treatises of government.
Yeah.
Now, that's why in American public schools prior to 50 years ago in government class, you would have read those two treatises.
Really?
Because that's where the, how can you study government not know where it came from? Will you read this? You will not read this today. And as you know, your version there is an inch thick, mine's 3/4 inch thick. They're both less than 400 pages long.
Yeah.
This book cites the Bible over 1,500 times to show the proper operation of civil government. Now
let me do the math here. That's got to be, what, 3-4 times a page?
3-4 times a page.
So you can't go a page without reading the Bible, and yet we're told these guys didn't respect
the
Bible. And
we're told they didn't, and we're told John Locke is a great deist, that he was one of the leading deists. You know,
yeah.
Weird thing about Locke as a deist, I wonder why he did this little book right here. This is called The Commonplace Book to the Bible. You open this up, and it's the Scripture's sufficiency practically demonstrated. Now, wait a minute, what's a deist doing showing us that the Bible applies to every aspect of life?
Yeah, I mean, think of it practically demonstrated. So he's saying this is how you use the Bible.
This is how you use the Bible in
your life.
And everything
a deist today would not do that.
No way. And so he talks to the reader and how applicable this is. And then he goes into here. And what he has done is he's taken all these verses out of the Bible and put them in categories. So the duty of a believer with respect to humility, the duties arising from religion relating husband and wife, religious duties toward God, and affliction and persecution. I mean, you take any category and you put the Bible verses together. Why would a deist do that?
Yeah, if you thought it was some watchmaker God that steps back and has nothing to do with us, you wouldn't be applying God's word to your marriage.
To your
and
marriage,
all these
everything.
Other things.
And see, that's the thing, is because he is the guy who had such a great impact. Because he had such a big impact, and because he is so religious. Oh no, he's a deist. You don't need to read his works in government class anymore. So, to show you how far we've come in our thinking, even as people of faith, I was recently with a group of about 500 pastors, and I said, how many Bible verses can you guys think of that deal with government? Less than 10 in the room. I said, here's a little book right here with more than 1,500.
Wow.
And he does say it is the Scriptures practically demonstrated, the sufficiency of the Scriptures. Bible applies to it. And the founders knew that. As a matter of fact, that's why if you look at the Declaration of Independence, those rights set forth in the Declaration, historians have documented that every single right set forth in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from the American pulpit prior to 1763. The Declaration of Independence is nothing more than a listen to the sermons we've been hearing
so
in church.
So the church was not applying government principles to our life. The church was applying the Bible, and that got reflected in our government principles. So if it was getting taught from the pulpit, it showed up in our government documents.
This guy right here, a guy named John Wise. John Wise, historians like Clinton Roster, and actually Cornell University, he was such a great historian, award-winning historian, that they have an endowed chair of history, the Clinton Roster Chair of History, a great historian. And he went back and said, you know, the American thinking was so different. No other nation did what we did. France didn't do it, Spain didn't do it, Portugal, Italy, no other nation.
So he had to be wondering why.
Why
would we do something different?
And his question, what were the six greatest intellectual forces in shaping the thinking of the founders? He went through and identified six greatest, and four of the six were preachers, and he was one of them. This guy right here, now these are his sermons from 1710 and 1717, and you'll find that by 1680, and he's a preacher in Massachusetts, you'll find by 1680, he had looked through the Bible, and he preaches a sermon. Well, looking at government in the Bible, it's very clear that God's preferred form of government is the consent of the governed. I think I've heard that phrase before. He looks through here, and he says,
"This was when?
This is 1680s.
So this is 100 years before.
1680s.
And he's already talking about consent of the governed. Okay.
And 100 years before, he says, you know, there is a creator, And he's created all men equal. And he's given them all the same set of rights.
Wow.
16A's. And he goes and he says, when you look at what the Bible says about taxation, it is very clear that taxation without representation is tyranny.
No kidding.
Right here.
So this is, I mean, when we say seeds of liberty, he was literally planting 100 years before what would bear fruit.
That's it. Well,
in our founding document.
Let me show you how significant this was, because he did this in 1680s. Tell me what the date of publication of that is right down there.
Oh, I have to read Roman numerals. This is going to be difficult. Okay, so this is 72? I was going to say 52, so that's 72. Okay, so 1770. So the founders then, in their era.
You know who the Sons of Liberty are.
Yeah.
All right. Who are the great Sons of Liberty?
So that was Sam Adams started
Sam
it, right?
Sam Adams and John Hancock and James Otis and all those guys' sons. They're the ones who
they reprinted his sermons
and distributed across America so Americans would know how to think going into this conference.
Okay, so wait. So these are sermons preached 100 years before the Declaration. The founders themselves reprinted his sermons.
Sons of Liberty.
To help educate their generation.
To get them thinking on right principles.
So, okay, this gives me great hope, because that means if they did it, if they could do this 200 and whatever years ago, reprint, re-educate, bring these things back to light, then we can do the same thing today.
Absolutely.
We bring these documents out.
That's educated.
A generation. They come back to these principles. We bring them.
And remember that principle number one, and it's demonstrated through here, but principle number one of the Declaration, there is a Creator. And if you don't recognize the Creator, then you got trouble. Now, this is the other thing we get today. The Founding Fathers, atheist, agnostic, deist. Really? You know, let me take something right here. This is, you tell me, what's the name at the bottom of this thing?
George Washington.
This is his first ever call to prayer in America at the federal government. That is Washington's.
1789.
This is going to be October the 17th, 1789. He calls the entire nation to honor God. Now, why would Washington do that? He gives the answer right here in this first paragraph. Let me just put it up. I'll show you what's in this first paragraph. Washington is now calling the nation to honor God. Why would he do it? He says, it's the duty. And notice the word duty. That's a word that is a big, important word. We don't talk about it much today. Military still gets it. A lot of the rural people know what duty means. I built houses for a long time. I had hundreds of thousands of dollars change hands. I never signed a contract in my life. I'd walk into the bank guy. We would talk about the terms. We would shake hands on it. Neither one of us would break that contract. That you have a duty to keep your word.
Yeah.
I don't need it on paper. I've got a duty.
And today you hear duty and people think, oh, responsibility. I don't want that. Yeah.
See, duty in his day is a legally binding contractual obligation. In 1913, the definition of duty was reduced to a responsibility, and today's dictionary says it's that which one ought to do. Well, that's not the same.
It's a choice. Sounds like a choice.
A choice.
Instead of this is what you do.
So what he's saying, it's a legally binding contractual obligation of who? Of nations. Legally binding contractual obligations of nations to do four things concerning God. Number one, to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God. Number two, to obey His will. Number three, to be grateful for His benefits. Number four, humbly to implore His protection and favor. And that's what nations are supposed to do, not individuals. So they believe this philosophy that you have to honor and recognize God as a culture.
But this is just the father of the country.
He's one of the great deist founding fathers, which is what we're told in school
today. But
he's
obligating the nation.
He's obligating
the nation.
The nation
has
the nation, not individuals. The nation has.
So all this stuff about official acts and, oh, you can keep your religion at home and you can talk about God, but don't even have a public day of prayer. Remember when our governor Rick Perry couldn't even pray with people in Houston?
Yeah, he got together.
Because he's governor, he's not allowed to pray with people because it's official. Exactly what we want is official prayer.
See that? What's that?
Proclamation for Thanksgiving.
It's handwritten. It's done by a guy named John Langdon. Oh, he's the governor. He's the signer of the Constitution.
Yeah,
so what do you mean a governor can't have prayer? Here's a governor who's signer of the Constitution. So the signer of the Constitution thought it was the right thing. You've also got Samuel Huntington. There's a signer of the Declaration. He's a call to prayer. He's now governor of his state. He calls the people to prayer.
So this is an official act
from
a governor.
Here's one from Oliver Wolcott, another signer of the Declaration, another governor of his state calling people to prayer. Here's one from John Langdon, governor of the state. Now, this is, that was handwritten. This is called a broadside because they would nail these up to trees or they nailed these up the side of barns. Evidently, somebody nailed it up and you see the part missing.
And tore it down, look.
and here you've got John Hancock. I mean, here's his. I mean, even behind us, we got all these things behind us. You know, if I go to this one right here, pull this one out, you'll recognize the guy there. Who's at the bottom?
So we're back to the Sons of Liberty. So here's Sam Adams when he's governor.
When he's governor.
Okay, now, this kind of ties it together for me. So Adams reprints, he and others reprint John Wise. So there's the principles from a pastor 100 years earlier. Now he's in an official capacity, and he's basically reiterating those exact same principles
exactly.
from John Wise.
And that's the first principle of American government, is you have to have something higher than government, and it was God.
Yeah.
And because God's higher than government, he gives us a certain set of rights to government. You cannot touch those rights. Now we have limited government. And by the way, government, you exist primarily to protect the rights that God told all of it. So we have a right to free speech. We have a right to self-defense. We have a right to sanctity of our home. We have a right to justice. We have a right to trial by jury. Government, you have to protect those rights. As all the things that they listed out as
but
rights.
But if you take the first principle out, all of that falls apart. You take God out. So these are the seeds of liberty.
These are the seeds of liberty.
This is what produced this most incredible nation in the history of the world. So if we go back to the seeds, we can bear same fruit that we've had.
Once you understand this, now we can talk about the Constitution, because now you'll understand the Constitution.
All right, well, we're going to step back and get a 30,000 feet view of the Constitution in our next section, kind of a broad overview of the entire Constitution when we return here on Constitution Alive with David Barton and Rick Green. Well, welcome back to Constitution Alive. We're finally ready to dive into the actual Constitution. First, we're going to step back and look at it from what I call a 30,000 feet view. I don't know about you guys, but I have a hard time just opening page one. As a kid, I always went to the back of the book, to see what was happening at the end. So I like to look at the whole thing. I want to look at the cover. I want to see the big picture first, and then I'm ready to dive into those specific areas. So for the next few minutes, we're going to literally fly through the entire Constitution and get a big picture of those seven articles and those 27 amendments. So we kind of know where the pieces are, and then we'll zero in. Most of our time will be on Article 1, Section 8, because we're going to talk about the enumerated powers of Congress, what Congress can actually do, or what Congress is supposed to be doing. So first we're going to step back, though, and look at the whole thing. And of course, you can't look at the whole thing without starting with that preamble. So I'm going to ask my daughter Cameron to come forward and join us. She's been wanting to get across that rail into this sacred room. Y'all welcome Cameron. Cameron Green's going to come join us. Come on up, baby. Right there. All right, share those first words that Gouverneur Morris wrote for us.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Great job, baby. Way to go. All right. Good job. Okay. If I was a smarter man, I'd have her teach the rest of the class. We'd be a lot better off. So, there you have the preamble. Morris wrote this one entirely himself. Now, the preamble, of course, doesn't have the force of law. So, I kind of think of it in terms of like a business letter where you got your RE colon, this is what the letter's about. And then you get into the meat of the letter. That's the way I think of the preamble. It sort of sets the stage for us of here's what the Constitution is going to be all about. I do want to point out, though, and that's why we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I do want to point out two very quick things out of the preamble. First of all, it's the first place we see this phrase, general welfare. So, we see promote the general welfare in the preamble. We're going to talk more about that when we get to Article 1, Section 8. But if you go back and you look at the Articles of Confederation, it helps us to understand general welfare in the Constitution itself. And the first thing I'll show you right here before we get into Article 1, Section 8 is the Webster's Dictionary of General Welfare. 1828 is the closest Webster's to the time. And here's what it said. It's exemption from any unusual evil or calamity, the enjoyment of peace and prosperity, or the ordinary blessings of society and civil government. And then there's three really important words. What are they? Applied to the states. So general welfare is not individual welfare. It's not the right of Congress to take something from you to give to someone else for their individual welfare. General welfare was for the states. It was for the system itself, to keep freedom for all of the states and for the system in general, not for individual welfare. We'll come back to that one a little later. I just wanted to point it out in the preamble. And then the last thing in the preamble I'd point out is the blessings of liberty. For those that say it's a godless constitution, I'm just wondering where those blessings are supposed to flow from. I like blessings of liberty being in there.
Quick break. Stay with me, folks. You're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America on At the Core.
At the Core podcasts are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
We're back here on At the Core with Walker Wildman and Rick Green. I'm Rick Green, America's Constitution Coach. We're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America. We're going to jump right back in where we left off before the break. I do have to make one comment, though, about the last segment. As David was teaching
And I was listening to that. It's wild to me that that particular part of biblical citizenship, we recorded that right at 10 years ago. So David Barton and I were sitting in his library walking through that part. The part you're about to hear or that you heard right as we were going to the break is actually just me in Independence Hall. But the other part where David and I were talking and he was going through those principles of the Declaration and that part about alter or abolish, it's just amazing to me that he pointed that out, taught that little more than 10 years ago. And that is now the essential part of our new course, Rebuilding Liberty. That's not what we're listening to right now. We're listening to Biblical Citizenship in Modern America, but we've got a new course that's just now really being launched for the 250th next year, and an essential piece of it as we break down the Declaration and celebrate it. We're going back to what David taught all those years ago and really getting into how do you properly, peacefully alter or abolish. So let's jump back in. This is Biblical Citizenship in Modern America.
Okay, let's take a look at the Constitution at a glance. And in your study guide, you've got a one-pager there of the whole Constitution on one page. And I do that so that I can see it at a glance and quickly figure out, okay, where was that issue of grandeur? Where was that particular issue? And I can go find it very quickly. But let's take a look at the whole thing. First, we've got seven articles. Okay, Article 1 is the legislative branch. So there's where we learn about Congress. Article 2 is the presidency. So that's our executive branch. We'll spend a little more time on that later. Article 3, the judicial branch. We're going to spend a lot of time on the judiciary. That's become a very, probably the most dangerous branch in terms of taking the Constitution and turning it into something it was never intended to be. Article 4 is about interstate relations. We're not going to come back to that much except to point out that there in Article 4, Section 4 is where we're guaranteed to be a republic, not a democracy. Article 5 is the amendment process. We will spend a little bit of time on that. Article 6 is where you get the supremacy clause. They validated the debts from the Confederacy, no religious tests, sorts of things like that. And then Article 7 is ratification. We won't spend any time on that in our class. So that's the seven articles. Now let's just run through real quick, get a big picture of the 27 amendments. So 27 times we've amended what these guys in this room initially did. So they put the Constitution in place, the states ratify, it becomes the law of the land. 27 times we've made changes, tweaks if you will, sometimes big changes, to that original Constitution. And I'm going to give these to you not necessarily in numerical order, but I call it buckets. I put them in buckets of what they do. So it's not what number they are, but what part of the Constitution do they amend. Of course, the Bill of Rights, that's our first 10 amendments. We're going to come back to that later and spend more specific time on it, but that's our first bucket. Let's just set those aside for right now. We'll come back. The second bucket are the amendments that affect the presidency. So I mentioned earlier, there's five amendments affecting the presidency. Now the 12th was simply correcting some what really was potentially a real problem in the Electoral College and choosing the president. Think about it this way. Back in their day, if you had someone who got the most votes became president in the Electoral College, most votes, and their arch rival becomes vice president, so that's their second in command. Back in the day of duels and assassinations and all, not a good idea, I don't think. So that didn't work out so well. Fortunately, they didn't actually assassinate anybody. But when Jefferson and Adams, when Adams was president and Jefferson, his arch rival, became vice president, I think everybody went, ding, 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 this is a problem. So 12th Amendment changes that. Now we get president and vice president coming from the same team, and you make sure your second in command is of the same philosophy that you are when you're running and going to back up what you're doing. So that's the 12th Amendment. 20th Amendment had to do with dates, and it essentially was trying to stop a lame duck Congress. Now back then, it was enough to stop a lame duck Congress. Today, of course, with our travel being so much easier, 2 months is plenty of time for these guys to wreak a lot of havoc and cause a lot of problems. If one party gets voted out in November, they've got 2 months where they can pass all kinds of stuff before the new Congress comes in January. So that might actually be a good place for us to have a new amendment that would tighten up those dates so you didn't have as much of an opportunity for a lame duck Congress. But 20th Amendment affects when the president and Congress come into power and are sworn in. 22nd Amendment. Easiest way to remember the 22nd Amendment for me, I just think two terms, all right? 22nd Amendment is when we limited the president to two terms. And think about why we did that. Remember what Rhett was saying earlier, how the only just powers of government come from the consent of the governed. So when we create a government, when we create a document and a way for that government to work, we the people are not giving power, we're loaning power to that government. And if we see something that needs to be tweaked or changed, the beauty of freedom is that we the people can take some of that power back. So we created a branch of government known as the executive, our president, and we didn't put a limit on how long someone could be president. Everybody followed Washington's example up until FDR, then you get that fourth term and everybody goes, yeah, this is kind of too long. In fact, we kind of started saying, you know, actually what's happening is this person is staying in, this branch is staying in power for so long, they're able to accumulate more and more power and they're getting too powerful. We don't like the idea of a king mentality, of somebody being there as long as they ever want to be. And so we the people reined in that branch, if you will, and we limited the presidency to two terms. That was us. We did that with the 22nd Amendment. So we said, here's the Constitution. We love it. Great things in it. But there's one area that needs to be tweaked. We the people tweaked it. We took back some of that power and limited the president to two terms. Might be a good idea to consider that for the other branches. I'm just saying, all right? So that's the 22nd Amendment. All right, so then you get the 23rd Amendment, also affects the president. So we're still in our bucket of amendments affecting the president. 23rd Amendment was where we added the Electoral College for District of Columbia. So District of Columbia has, according to the Constitution, a very special place in our land. It was not intended to be a state. They did not want it to be within a state. So if you had the seat of the federal government in Texas, for instance, or in your home state, then you would either have favors for that particular state, or you could potentially have problems where there was too much conflict and you know, didn't want that. So what the Founding Fathers did was they set aside D.C., no more than 10 square miles. They said that's going to be the seat of federal government, not a state, not within a state. Well, now that it's become such a populous area and there's so many people there, the American people said, you know, those people should have a voice in the presidency. They should have a voice in at least one branch of our three branches of government, so we're going to let them have Electoral College votes. So we the people, again, amended the Constitution. It wasn't something Congress did on their own. We the people said, we want them to have Electoral College votes. So now the people in the District of Columbia get to vote for president, and they get three Electoral College votes. No problem. That's the 23rd Amendment. Now, statehood for D.C. is a totally different issue, because if you give D.C. statehood, now you've actually got a constitutional problem. If you give them statehood without amending the Constitution, then the Constitution says that D.C. will be governed by Congress, but now you make them a state, who's going to govern them? Congress, or does the state govern them? You got to rule. Now, if we the people amend the Constitution and make D.C. a state, hey, if I lose that battle, I lose. That's fine. I won't be for it because I like the idea of it being a special place that is not a state, but if I lose that battle, fine. If it's done constitutionally. The Congress is the one that decides whether or not to add a state. So they could do it. It wouldn't be a violation of the Constitution for them to get D.C. statehood, but it creates that problem in the Constitution. But D.C. statehood is a different issue. The 23rd Amendment simply dealt with giving D.C. residents the right to vote for president. And then the 25th Amendment is, of course, when the president is incapacitated. That's one of the ones we'll come back to. A lot of these amendments I'm going to fly through in our kind of 30,000 feet flyover, we're not going to come back to. Here's one we're not going to come back to. It's another bucket of amendments. It's the bucket of judicial amendments, and there's only one. It's the 11th Amendment, and it dealt with a very specific kind of suit when a citizen outside of a state was suing that state. And so initially, they had given original jurisdiction to the federal courts. It happened very quickly after the Constitution was adopted. It was actually Georgia got sued by a non-citizen, and the states all said, whoa, we don't like this idea of the feds having original jurisdiction. So the 11th Amendment was adopted. Another boring issue. We're not going to come back to it. Okay. Three amendments in our next bucket. This is the congressional amendments. So we have three amendments actually affecting Congress. 17th, 20th, we already talked about. It affected Congress and the president, so it's in both those buckets. So 17th and 27th. 17th is, in my humble opinion, the second worst amendment to the Constitution. And the reason I say that is because what it did was it changed the way we choose our senators. What these guys put in place, they said, you know, this is going to be a very special form of a republic. Our system of federalism is going to be different than what anybody else had, because what we want is we want, at the federal level, we want representation for the people, and that's our House of Representatives. Every 2 years they run. We want representation for the states, and that's our Senate. And those senators will be chosen by the states, by the state legislatures. And so you can imagine, if the state legislature is choosing the U.S. senators, then the Senate is going to be the place that keeps the federal government from encroaching on the states, because those U.S. senators answer to the state legislators. As a former legislator, I can tell you, if the feds are considering a bill that's going to take away some of my turf, some of my power as a state legislator, or my state able to run something the way it wants to run it, and the feds are considering that, I'm going to be on the phone to that U.S. senator, and if that U.S. senator's elected by this handful of legislators, that U.S. senator is going to respond. And that U.S. senator is going to stop the feds from encroaching upon the states. 17th Amendment, 1913, changes that. And no longer are those senators chosen by the legislature, they're elected by the people at large, direct election of senators. What happened was, after that, you can look at the hockey stick growth of the federal government, not just in terms of size, but in terms of jurisdiction. Because now, you got the U.S. senators coming home and saying, oh, I'm gonna take care of you. I'm gonna bring your individual welfare from the federal level, and there's nobody to stop them. There's no longer that buffer of the state saying no through the U.S. Senate. So now the House and the Senate are essentially doing the same thing. So it's been a very bad thing in terms of jurisdictional government and moving so much of our stuff to Washington, D.C. It was slowly, in some ways I blame the folks in 1913 for adopting the amendment, but it was already slowly happening. Several of the states had already chosen through their state legislatures to no longer choose their U.S. senators through the legislature. They were putting it on the ballot and then they were choosing, but they were just rubber stamping what happened to the ballot box. So it was sort of happening over time, but in 1913, that's when that amendment was adopted. Now our next bucket are the civil rights amendments and amendments that end slavery, the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments. Boy, we could spend all night just on these three. 13th, end slavery. 14th Amendment was specifically put in because if you think about it, you had a lot of states in the South that even though slavery had ended, they were not protecting the rights of former slaves. They weren't letting them vote. You name it, whatever the issue was. They weren't given equal protection, if you will. So the 14th Amendment was designed to say, hey, we're going to make sure that the rights that one citizen has in a state are protected and guaranteed to every other citizen in the state. Now here's the deal with the 14th, folks. We could spend a year on the 14th Amendment. It's a major area of jurisprudence. In legal communities, there's a split over what the 14th Amendment actually does. And this is the furthest in the weeds I'm gonna go, so stay with me for just like the next 3 minutes. There's a debate over whether the 14th Amendment incorporates, or if you will, applies the Constitution to the states. Just know that 14th Amendment jurisprudence is a whole subject in and of itself, and what we see today is that the 14th Amendment is used to protect us from our state and local governments or anybody else with regard to all those constitutional amendments. It does a lot more, but that's all we're going to cover in our quick start guide. Okay, 15th Amendment was specific to voting. Now, I know, 14th should have already guaranteed that, but you still had all these white-only primaries, all these problems in the South that were keeping blacks from being able to vote. And so the 15th Amendment was to specifically say, you have a constitutional right to vote, and it cannot be infringed based on the color of your skin. So that was a very important amendment to get passed. And that actually opens us to our next bucket. There's four amendments that specifically are a bucket of amendments that deal with voting. So I'm going to ask my baby girl Cameron to come back up, and she's going to explain these four amendments on voting. Y'all welcome Cameron. She's going to come back. All yours, sweetie.
There are four amendments that protect your right to vote. The 15th Amendment guarantees that we can vote no matter what the color of our skin. The 26th Amendment says you must be at least 18 years old to vote, so that means I still got six more years to go. Amendment 24 protects the right to vote whether we're rich or poor. And last is my personal favorite. The 19th Amendment makes sure that we ladies have the same rights as the guys when choosing our leaders. Our right to vote is protected throughout the Constitution, so don't waste it. Every chance you get to vote, let your voice be heard and values counted.
Good job, baby. All right. Can't imagine why the 19th is her favorite one. You know, we always call that women's suffrage. Let me let you in on a little secret. The men were not letting the women vote, and so the women were making the men suffer. I promise you. Okay, that's the real reason it's called suffrage. Anyway, so that fortunately we got it right. And actually, I find it interesting. Those amendments are a good example of how this American system of government has allowed for us to become a more perfect union. When we got something wrong, America tends to figure out a way to get it right. I mean, think about it. Even when it comes to the right of women to vote. Well, the men were the ones that had to vote on that amendment. So the majority ended up giving the minority the opportunity to participate. Same thing with ending slavery and civil rights. It's the majority that has, after often a long battle, comes around and says, you know what, let's get this thing right and make sure that everybody gets to enjoy these same freedoms. So I think that's a unique experience in America. You don't usually see that in other countries. If a majority has power, they continue to oppress and they don't share that power and those freedoms with the others. So there's your bucket of amendments that have to do with voting. Just a few more here. We've got everybody's favorite amendment to the Constitution, the 16th Amendment. No laughter, no amen, no yes, no yeehaw, nothing, right? Nobody likes the 16th Amendment, the income tax. Now look, two things on this. We're not going to spend any time debating whether or not it was properly ratified. I hear all these arguments and people say it wasn't ratified right and because the comma was in the wrong place.
Well, you have to tune in on Thursday, where we're going to pick up, where we're having an interrupt right here, to find out why you can't buy into this thing about it not being ratified correctly. A lot more to cover. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, we're going to do this on Thanksgiving on Thursday, diving even more into these principles, because there's so much to be thankful for here. And then we'll probably do at least one more episode of Biblical Citizenship in Modern America before we go back to doing phone calls and that sort of thing. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. Be back with you on Thursday with more Biblical Citizenship. You've been listening to At the Core with Waka Waka Rick Green.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.